This is young blood Holden with the one and only Bob Dobbs, the Dragon Bone Chair himself. And we're actually getting ready to interview a man named Eric Dobson. He is a professor at the University of West Georgia. And Eric, I had a little intro for you, but for some reason I'm a little tongue-tied. Let me just shoot straight from the hip. I actually went to school at the University of West Georgia, and this man, Eric Dobson, was actually very inspirational to me. He was one of the few professors who understood my vision and was very helpful in my development, my career. And actually, Eric, that's part of Eric's vibe. He actually has been Teacher of the Year. Eric, you can fill in here, Teacher of the Year. And he inspires students, is what I'm saying. He's also he is a Renaissance man. He has a band. He's a computer programmer, speaks multiple languages. He's a poet, a public speaker. He is one of the third generation of the humanistic psychologists, a great thinker, one of the greatest thinkers of today, if I may be so bold. Eric, what say you, Eric Dobson?
Well, first of all, you're making me blush with all of that.
It was better in my head.
But it's true, right?
Pardon?
It's true?
I couldn't hear you.
It's true?
Yeah, pretty much all the stuff he said is pretty accurate. You know, I was a systems engineer. Then I got a doctorate in psychology, phenomenological psychology. And, you know, I've written poetry. I'm in a rock band. What else did you say?
I thought you were in sociology.
No, phenomenological psychology, existential phenomenological psychology.
Is that Merleau-Ponty school when you say
yes,
phenomenological?
Yes, Merleau-Ponty is one of the principal existential phenomenologists. Yeah. So
He made much impact in the States, but he's an established school over here?
Yeah. Well, anyone who's into phenomenological psychology has heard of Merleau-Ponty and has probably read him. Probably read the Phenomenology of Perception or the Structure of Behavior, or the Primacy of Perception, or you know any of his other kind of big thick books.
When did he become acceptable for American college curricula?
Well, I don't know if he's acceptable. It's more the case that I'm on the margins or the periphery of the psychological project, so I wouldn't want to suggest that he's kind of at the center of it. It's more like I'm at the margins of it, and consequently, so is Merleau-Ponty. But you know,
I see. Are there many colleagues you have in the States who study Merleau-Ponty that you're in touch with?
Oh yeah. You know, the university I went to when I got my master's and doctorate in psychology was phenomenologically oriented. So more or less, all the faculty there were into Merleau-Ponty, and all the students. We all read Merleau-Ponty and pretty much took his...
Where was that?
Seriously.
What university?
That was Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay, so in my non-academic knowledge, McLuhan, who I'm the expert on McLuhan, and when Roland Barthes died, the late 70s or 1980, they said... A Canadian journalist who knew McLuhan well said that Barthes was the McLuhan of France. Hmm. And then when the letters of McLuhan came out, McLuhan had met Barthes, and he was answering that journalist in response to that article. McLuhan was still alive. So that means that Barthes must have died in 78 or so, because McLuhan's gone 79, 80. So... McLuhan said that Barthes was a phenomenologist dealing with the concepts of the day. And McLuhan said, I'm a phenomenologist who doesn't deal with the concepts of the day, conventional concepts. So then when I read McLuhan quoting or talking about Merleau-Ponty, it was about Merleau-Ponty was like McLuhan. He dealt with percepts, not concepts. And that's what McLuhan would say, but I don't know what that would mean in your language or your thing. But Merleau-Ponty was one of the philosophers, whatever, who moved towards what McLuhan thought he was working on, percept, but McLuhan would say that he went further than Merleau-Ponty. So that's how I would relate what I know about Merleau-Ponty. What do you know about McLuhan?
Well, I just kind of have a layman's knowledge. You know, the medium is the message, and more
right.
or less what the implications of that are. And the way I take that sort of epigram is that, well, you know, he was writing about television, I think, at the time. And
yes.
The idea is that, well, you know, if you want to understand what television is about, you can't really look at the content of the program so much as look at how television is operating as a structural principle of consciousness, subjectivity, and sociality. So the medium, television itself, is the message insofar as it becomes a kind of structural operative principle ultimately of our lives, both individually and collectively.
Now, what you just said, is that phenomenological talk?
That would be consonant with phenomenological talk, certainly. You know, conceiving
yeah.
of things in terms of percepts would be. That's
yeah.
very much phenomenological talk. So if McLuhan felt that that's what he was doing, then he was very much in alignment with the way phenomenologists would typically talk about their work. I think also the other way in which McLuhan intersects with phenomenology is that, you know, McLuhan, to my reading, took very seriously the idea that, well, we are embedded with the world, that the world we inhabit structures who and what we are every bit as much as who and what we are structures the world. And so he
yeah.
seemed to be, to my layman's perception, I don't know enough about McLuhan to go into the nuts and bolts of it, but at least to my perception, he seemed to take that idea very seriously, and insofar as he did, that would put him in good existential phenomenological camp as well.
No, you're right. And now the thing is, he knew that's what you guys in existentialism were saying, but he felt that he went further. And I don't know if we can get into that because you're not familiar with the deeper McLuhan, but I guess basically he would see humanistic psychology as still literate people perceiving perceptual involvement, but putting it back into literary framework for literate people. And McLuhan would be further out in the frontier saying, no, there's no literate context here for the new generations being molded by television or the internet and that.
Yeah,
I think
you're right. And I think that begins to form a kind of critique of humanistic psychology. And I think it's,
yes.
to an extent, an accurate critique of it. My own way of thinking about it is that we're moving into a post-literate phase in our historical evolution.
Post-literate.
And I think what's happening is that we're becoming much more what I call iconographic. In other words, the processes whereby we construe the world and begin to make and form meaning are much more about manipulating images and sound bites and much less about traditional forms of meaning making, which would be things like constructing narratives that are meaningful and so on, and ideology. So it's much more fragmentary. The processes of making meaning are much more fragmentary. So I think McLuhan's idea that in some ways he's gone beyond what the humanistic psychologists have said is probably there's some accuracy in that, at least there is to my perception, because I think a lot of humanistic psychologists, or even probably more accurately psychologists generally speaking, are pretty much wedded to the paradigm that tries to construe the world and our lives in terms of narratively structured meaning, and is very loath to take seriously the idea of something like an iconographic or image-oriented mode of consciousness.
But he spoke of we're in a post-literate situation, and that's what you're all about, the post-information environment. Maybe you can explain that to Eric. That might help him. Now, Eric, I see on your website here that you're actually writing currently. Bob might be interested to know this. He's actually writing Humanistic Psychology for the 21st Century for the American Humanistic, what is the AHP again, Eric? I'm forgetting.
The Association of Humanistic Psychology. That's the AHP.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
So,
you know, part, one of my interests is to sort of retool humanistic psychology in light of the kinds of things, the kind of phenomena that Bob was just describing, which I'm construing in terms of a fundamental shift in consciousness and meaning-making process that's running throughout our culture. I think that humanistic psychology would do well to update itself in light of some of this stuff.
Okay, so Eric, what about the dialectic of right hemisphere and left hemisphere? Is that acceptable at all in humanistic psychology?
Well, it is as a kind of metaphor. They're humanistic psychologists don't usually found themselves a lot on neurology and sort of neurological distinctions. And part of the reason why is because, like you said in the beginning, they're much more interested in percepts than anything else. In other words,
right.
They like to ground their insights in terms of experience and how it is that we can glean meanings in our experience by reflecting on it in various ways. And so for them, the distinction between right and left hemisphere becomes kind of useful and incisive insofar as it's kind of a helpful metaphor for getting at certain aspects or certain kind of sensibility that runs throughout our lives. And so they don't take it as seriously as some people do. I think the way people normally take that is as a kind of neurologically grounded element of our reality, and the humanistic psychologists, they would include that. They wouldn't dismiss it out of hand, but on the other hand, they tend not to emphasize it that much. So it's more of a metaphor or a trope.
Yeah, so McLuhan took what he had in the 70s. He would look around to see what academics in different fields were coming up with some kind of new pattern, some pressure to think differently, and he would tell them that you're doing that because of television or satellites or the computer.
Yeah.
He would point out that this whole society, including academic disciplines or professional therapeutic disciplines, were being affected by media like everybody. And so he used the right hemisphere or left hemisphere dialectic by saying, right hemisphere, according to the scientists who use that model, moves into imagery and less writing and naming, and that's more left hemisphere, and we were moving into an iconographic society, but he would call that right hemisphere, just to put on the thinking of that day. Now,
yeah.
If he was here today, and there was a whole different model, he would use that, but he would always point out that you people are trying to describe it and fit it into your discipline's concepts, but the environmental perceptual ground is what's ahead of your concepts. And
yeah.
That's what Merleau Ponty was pointing to.
Well, all the existential phenomenologists are pointing to that, not just Merleau Ponty.
Yes.
Because
right. So McLuhan would say, well, existentialism, as much as Sartre and whoever came after him, presented in books as concepts, he would say that's them just responding to the larger television environment in the 40s and 50s.
And moreover, I would say, to update it a little for the 21st century, the internet environment, the computer environment, the video gaming environment, it's much larger today than merely TV, the way iconographic consciousness is, proliferating and expanding itself and evolving. And
oh, yeah. That's analog media TV. The digital, what I call Android meme, is such a powerful thing that the world that McLuhan wrote about is so puny compared to today.
Right. It's very much been multiplied many times, but the same principle holds, I think. That, McLuhan's fundamental insight, which I think in a technologically driven world and social state, that the technologies infiltrate into our subjectivity and begin to structure out our ideas, our concepts, our meanings, our insights, our sense for what life is, I think holds true today, probably even more so, I would say, than in McLuhan.
More so because it's more obvious. The changes happen faster.
And that's true. And also, we, I think, on the average, spend much more time being present to these kinds of technologies, too, many more hours per day.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, the TV used to go off at 12 o'clock, and they'd play the national anthem.
Yeah.
TV doesn't go off at all. The internet doesn't go off at all anymore.
Yeah, the 1,000 channels do not go off. You're talking about one or two stations going off at midnight.
Right. So, I think Marshall McLuhan's insight is every bit as relevant today, in fact, more so than it ever was.
Right. And what he was pointing to was that Finnegan's Wake was the map that showed, and subsequent McLuhan scholars like myself and Don Thiel see Finnegan's Wake is almost more relevant than McLuhan, but McLuhan was explaining Finnegan's Wake, so they go hand in hand. But if you look at a page of Finnegan's Wake, more and more it's our society and the multimedia and interacting and texting and confusion that goes on 24/7. Have you ever looked at a page of Finnegan's Wake?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think that's true. And Finnegan's Wake would be a kind of illustration, I think, of the disruption of the normal narrative structure and flow that is the traditional process of making meaning that the Western world relied upon for many centuries.
Right. So humanistic psychology and all disciplines, including Wall Street, have all collapsed dealing with this. So I'm interested in how radical you would adapt, or are you going to put it, always fit it back into literate concepts, which would only fit in the West and North America?
I'm
wouldn't
not
apply
one
to...
on making on living in the prison house of language.
Okay,
personally.
Good.
Like I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm not going to defend that position. Like I'm interested in the proliferation and the expansion of consciousness. If it moves in a ways that seem transgressive with respect to traditional values and mores and so on, I say more's the power on that score. So I'm not one of these academicians who's going to weep and wring his hands over the demise of literate consciousness. I think that iconographic consciousness or right brain consciousness probably has its potencies and also its shortcomings too. We would do well to embrace both. It's what would it be, after all, if not another formation of life, you know? And I think part of our task as human beings is to come into as broad and wide and deep a formation of life as we possibly can. So if psychology needs to update itself and move more in iconographic ways, I say let's get to it.
Yeah, now, iconographic... It's McLuhan who popularized the word iconoscope, iconic, and all that. People first came across that word in pop culture or just general educated culture through McLuhan. So I find it interesting you pick that word, and that's a very McLuhanistic word.
Well, I've also been in the Baudrillard a fair amount along the way.
Well, that's McLuhan.
Yes, who's constantly quoting McLuhan. And it was, I think, very much influenced by McLuhan. And so
nothing but McLuhan.
Huh?
Nothing but McLuhan is Baudrillard. He admits it later. He did not emphasize it in the 80s.
Yeah.
But
well,
in the 90s in interviews.
It. In fact, I would say that Baudrillard is an expansion and updating of the central principle, the medium is the message. You know, the idea of the hyper-real and all that is nothing more.
No, exactly. He is more important than McLuhan for later generations, and he pointed out that the medium, you do not have individual media anymore. He pointed that out in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He said the principle, the medium is the message, is true, but we don't have a medium anymore.
Yeah.
Is what he, that's where he went past McLuhan. He was
right,
more.
Right, and exactly, there's no medium anymore. But moreover, there's, in a sense, there's no we anymore either that would have a medium in the first place. Moreover, having has been disrupted as well. So we have a medium. All three of those elements in that sentence have been dissolved at this point.
Right. And the way, so the term McLuhan used for pointing towards that, he understood what, he would have understood Baudrillard because McLuhan was pointing to that. He used to use the phrase seamless web. But if you look at a page of Finnegan's Wake, that's a seamless web, and there's no we or have or medium. That's why the language of Finnegan's Wake is more our present than Baudrillard, and that would be my critique of Baudrillard. And I met him and told him that he's leaving out the Finnegan's Wake perception. And, of course, it didn't bother him. He was famous anyways. But, you know, knowing that where he came from, Don Thiel and I told him that, you know, you're missing the role of Finnegan's Wake in this situation. Because Finnegan's Wake can remain more relevant because it's so incomprehensible, so to speak, that any decade that McLuhan gets identified with, that passes. Baudrillard gets identified with the 80s, 90s, that passes.
Yeah.
Finnegan's Wake, by its very nature, stays relevant because it's further out than anything that's ever been written.
Yeah, well, and also it came chronologically prior to all of these theories as well, you know, so it's sort of...
But he was taking on, he uses the word existential here and there, whatever it was for him. I don't be Heidegger, I don't know where he would get it from, because he dies in 41, and that's before Sartre, but he knew the word and used
Heidegger
it.
Heidegger died in 76, I think.
No, I meant Sartre died. I mean, what am I saying? Joyce died in 41.
Oh, okay, Joyce,
so
yeah.
He would not know Sartre or Heidegger, probably. Yeah. But whoever was around, I don't know, who would be a philosopher? I guess Nietzsche, maybe. Who would be before Heidegger?
I'm sorry?
Who would be, quote, existential-like before Heidegger? Nietzsche?
Well, you know, the sort of existential, the progenitor of existentialism, as we now know
Kierkegaard.
Was Kierkegaard, exactly. And
right, so,
so
Kierkegaard would have been known.
Yeah, I mean, they're antecedents. You can point, like, they're at the sort of existential themes running through Pascal and Heraclitus and other people
right.
antedated Kierkegaard, but he's generally regarded as the first sort of card-carrying existentialist, and he lived in the first half of the 19th century. And then there were other 19th century figures like Dostoevsky, and Nietzsche's regarded as an existentialist. People debate that, academicians debate that, whether he properly belongs in that category or not.
Right.
Mostly because of his...
So McLuhan would point out that that Kierkegaard's first book, I think it was called Concept of Dread, came out in 1844, right when the telegraph was happening. So McLuhan would look at the larger cross-cultural phenomena and see Kierkegaard as one of them, picking up the effects, the post-literary effects of the telegraph. That's how McLuhan would look at it.
Yeah, well, that seems a very sensible way of looking at it. I think that when you look at the sort of artistic record, the literary record, and the poetic record, along with the philosophical record, there seem, to my perception anyhow, to be remarkable parallelism in the way things shift, the way movements in art shift with respect to movements in philosophy and so on. And so I think that it's not too hard an argument to make that, well, what's really happening is different manifestations and shifts in the larger world context, and that's really what's going on, you know, manifesting itself philosophically, manifesting itself artistically, poetically, in terms of literature.
And scientifically.
Yes, and scientifically as well. You know, it's probably no accident that, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity and so on came out, well, at the turn of the century, late 19th, early 20th century, like that sort of thing.
The same time as Freud and Cubism.
Yes, Freud and Cubism, you know, things are becoming much more relative all the way around, you know.
Yeah.
The truth that you take is relative to the workings of your unconscious, according to Freud. The truth.
Right, so McLuhan said the unconscious, doesn't have to be a Platonic idea or Aristotelian idea. It is your concrete, immediate experience in the medium that the society is reacting to. So you got telegraph and movies, creates Freudianism, Cubism, Einstein, Stravinsky, all across. He would look at the technology. Now, you've read enough Baudrillard, and that would familiarize with the background of McLuhan, so you get what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. But I would say also the other side of the dialectic is equally true, that all of these theories bend back upon the world of technological possibilities and provide fertile ground for the advent of new ones as well. So I think it's a real dialectical process. And not just a
okay, is that a dialogue between percept and concept?
Well, I think so. I think that would be one way of putting it. You know, that the world as we experience it and perceive it informs how we conceptualize it, and how we conceptualize it informs how we perceive it as well. That it's an ongoing mutual reciprocal relationship. And that's why it's so important to do these analyses of technologically based culture and wonder about the place of narrative and wonder about the place of image and icon, because it's part of the world we inhabit that inescapably will sort of inform and shape our subjectivity every bit as much as how our subjectivity informs and shapes the world as we construct it. And
right.
The reason
now,
why I think it's important to understand that is because if we don't take up the task of understanding it, then we risk, you know, creating some kind of hell on earth for ourselves, I think.
Well, you get one-sided. So yes, the dialogue in his early books he talked about between the pictorial and the verbal, but he certainly was including concepts equal in a sense to the perceptual, but since the perceptual was so unfamiliar to the general audience, they were naturally literate and conceptual. So he overemphasized the perceptual, he said, in the 60s, and he suppressed consciously the subjective or the conceptual, which became a phrase that he's not known for as much in the 70s, the user is the content.
Hmm.
The medium is the message and the user is the content. And the dialectic between that he develops. And as you move into the digital, the user becomes the king and the formal dynamic, not the medium, which is what Baudrillard was getting at in his terms.
Of course, the problem is, you know, how we constitute a user. Like, what is exactly a user? Well, usually people would answer that at some level with, well, a user is a person or a human being. But the problem is that if how you conceive or understand the human condition is being ongoingly changed and shaped and shifted by the dynamisms that are running throughout our world context, well, then at some point that can't help but infiltrate and change what we mean by the word human and consequently what we mean by the word user.
Yes. That's what McLuhan, he logged the changes in the meanings of words and references and showed how the changes could be understood by the qualities of the new media. And the media was a guide to the why in the 20s the word cool had one particular meaning and then had a different meaning in the 60s.
Yes,
because the media changed.
Right, exactly. And as the media change and our subjectivity changes and words and language change correlatively, it sets up an infinite ongoing task of tracing the contours of ongoing unfolding rather than relying on static conceptions or thinking we have the answer or something like that, something dull like that. So in other words, it sets up the task of understanding who we are, which is part of what I'm interested in as a psychologist, as something ultimately impossible, which is part of its charm. It's one of the impossible professions, according to Freud, understand and teach who and what we are, you know. But to me, the whole project of that kind of understanding is only intensified and made more vivid and interesting and colorful and so on by the fact that it's now impossible. But that's just me, you know.
No, I agree. No,
there are a lot of people around who indulge, since you've read Baudrillard, in what Baudrillard calls a kind of nostalgia, right? Nostalgia for the modern, for the real, and so on. In other words, for a static way of seeing things, a static way of looking at things, and all of that kind of stuff. In other words, stasis in its generality. And I think that our task is the sector of the academic project that seeks to understand what we are in the world in which we live. One of our tasks is to move away from that kind of static-based project of thinking and understanding, the one that embodies a much greater degree of dynamism and mutability and all of that kind of stuff. In other words, it's more of an adventure.
Right. Now, here's, in McLuhan's day, he would say that the nostalgia for the real was nostalgia for literacy or the visual effect and not able to, in response to the new tactile effect. Now, he would lay out the looking back, the rearview mirror on different phases, you know, in the TV era, they'd look back to movie sensibility. In the movie sensibility, they'd look back to the book. In the book sensibility, they'd look back to the oral. Now, that's the way it was up till the time of Baudrillard, where there are no more media. And so Baudrillard's language, if you were tracking the media particular technological effects, the real and the terms he used are not appropriate. But when you recognize that in the post-McLuhan Baudrillard era, the real and those terms are applicable and better than using media terms. Okay? So if one knows McLuhan, then you know what to drop with McLuhan and understand why Baudrillard is saying the nostalgia for the real, because the real would be a combination of satellite, computer, TV and radio and magazines and books, that whole media complex, what I used to call mixed corporate media. There's a nostalgia for that. And Baudrillard was correct about that.
Well, there's a nostalgia for everything except embracing the world as we encounter it, which means embracing impermanence, embracing the constant shifting of the ground underneath our feet. And here's where, you know, all of this stuff, to my sensibility, begins to intersect, of all things, with a Buddhist kind of framework. Because the Buddhists, to me, have one of the most interesting and, I think, powerful takes on impermanence and why it is that we would feel these pull, this nostalgic pull, and the kind of hold that it has over us, and what it ends up doing to our lives. In other words, generating, from their point of view, lots of suffering, in essence.
Right. Now, I understand that position. In my chart, that's the Thompson quadrant. But I see Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam, Hinduism, they're products of the manuscript phase. Now, for those that still require literate references or the left hemisphere, Buddhism conceptually is more appropriate to our time. But I think that is so dramatic what we're in that you can't even begin to use any of those religious concepts, because technically people now can get a stasis in the media terms by making their own website. This is where the user is, content is inflated. So there's a kind of stability for the young hypertexting kids. On the surface, to older people, they look like they're manic, you know, 40,000 messages a month, but there's an underlying solidity that the modern technology gives them. Now, that's a seduction, but I certainly wouldn't limit myself to religious concepts in this. You probably pointing beyond that, but I know it's more dramatic than the concepts of Buddhism or the percepts of Buddhism. They do not meet what's happening here today.
Well, we might have a point of disagreement there. I think that at least at certain sectors of Buddhism, the ones I'm interested in, are the ones that say things like, if you're reading this book and trying to glean meanings from it, you're already off the mark. You know, if you're trying to conceptualize, let's say, what Zen is, you're already making a mistake.
Right, but our technology has people live that way. What's the most common response today? Whatever.
Yeah.
You would not 100 years ago go around going, whatever. You had to know and be able to verbalize what you were.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Bob, let me jump in there. I think we're at a good segue point. Actually, the common response now is not whatever, it's whatever. It's actually been
said. Yes.
But Bob,
well,
what
they don't even have time to say the full whatever. They got to just,
right.
There's no time to just say a short version.
Yeah.
Bob, if I can just stop the recording and start it again to make we have all of this. Is that okay? We can do that real quick.
Yeah.
This is Youngblood Holden here about the Bob Show. I'm here with the co-host of the show, Bob Dobbs, the Dragon Bone Chair himself. Bob, say a few words for our audience. Our audience, I just got a message from one of our fans. It says, quote, "We want Bob," 3 exclamations. "We want Bob," 3 exclamations. Give him Bob, Bob.
Who's that? Can you name the person?
One of our fans. I can't name her. I have to see if she wants to be named.
Okay.
I just got
it. All right. Very good. I wanted to note that the ending of the second show where you didn't know how to say goodbye.
Correct.
You remember that?
Oh, I remember.
That's a really good point. A very good metaphor for communication, the drama of blocking and merging, and the drama of cognition, the drama of the stages of apprehension. So I was thinking this, is that when you've engaged with someone, you're with them, you're visiting them. Now you've got to disengage, and you don't want to emphasize the fact you're actually blocking them out of your life, so to speak, and disconnecting. You do not want to present that rudely and bluntly. So you try to keep an after image of the merging that's happened, the tendency toward merging, overlapping each other's universes. And you try to keep that going to contradict the finality of the goodbye. You see?
I like it.
Yeah, now that's a very doubleness, contradictory process that Eric was talking about. Eric Dodson, that's Dodson, very close to Dobson, but it's DOD, Department of Defense. So Eric was trying to point out how maintaining both tendencies, both polarities of a concept in the mind at the same time. Well, actually, and you're acting out that behaviorally when you are sensitive to the dynamic of saying goodbye. Now, you can get real sensitive about it, but then that's too much. The person knows you're trying to be sensitive, and they'll say, well, look, I'm disengaging too. They'll imply this. And goodbye. You know what I mean? You ever notice that people go, goodbye, right, 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 goodbye. You know, and so one of them, usually the host, can go, goodbye, and it and stops it. Because the guest is leaving with a bit of a debt for the hospitality, but has to go, and the host understands that and knows the guest is being polite, but then the politeness becomes too much, so then it flips, and the host says goodbye, or emphasize it stronger. It's just it was a good example of the ongoing drama that Eric's talking about, you know, this what's going to happen next. Well, that whole issue is right in the way people say goodbye.
Well, that's what I'm what's about. That's what I'm about, Bob, bringing up good topics. Now,
yeah.
Bob, have you heard about this recent shooting in the news in Arizona? This guy, he went crazy. He shot a bunch of people, including a senator. It's all the rage now in the media cycle. What say you regarding this?
The interesting thing is, Ion did say, it will sicken you over the next week, Bob, the noise and hoopla about this incident. It's going to become a big deal. And I don't watch the news that much, or don't do it at all, really. So I didn't care. I wasn't going to track it. But I do look at Drudge or something to get a gist of the headline at least once a day, right? What's the headline? Because you, as a civic responsibility, you have to know what the Android meme is saying just so I can answer a person like yourself who brings it up. Yeah, I know what you're referring to. Don't know much of the details. But what struck me is the noise started, the girlfriend of the guy or some friend, female friend, pointed out that he didn't listen to anything. He wasn't influenced by the right wing or left wing or nothing. This whole screaming out about Sarah Palin, Rush Limbaugh, and the left saying they caused it was just snipped away, you know, canceled by the girlfriend who said this guy didn't take in any information, which to me proved it was a post-information society and these talk show guys are nothing. They don't have any influence on anything anymore. It's just the after image of the Android meme, you know. And so that was the validating part of the story so far. I was delighted to hear that she canceled the finger pointing by saying this guy wasn't influenced by any of you idiots, left or right. And he had no point of view. It was for other reasons that he did this, if there were any reasons. And basically, it's a guy on an identity quest. And, you know, as McLuhan used to point out, violence is what happens when you're on an identity quest. You're trying to recover an old image of yourself or forge a new one. It's a violent process. And that's why he's grinning. I mean, I just caught this image. I don't know if he's grinning today, but when they brought him in a couple of days ago, he started grinning because, you know, he's discovering new effects that he never foresaw. He's having an adventure. He's a, you know, psychopathic probe on himself.
Yeah, well, he is somebody. He has his own cover of Time magazine, very enduring image that will probably surpass Marilyn Manson as the crazy-eyed killer. It's a better crazy-eyed killer than Marilyn Manson, I must tell you.
You mean Charles Manson?
Yeah, I'm calling him Marilyn Manson. You can do a probe on that. Charles Manson has become Marilyn Manson. There you go.
And the guy, who knows what he's aware of? The point is the guy was probing. He wanted to probe pain in himself and others, and he did it. And the thing is, he's getting effects that he didn't foresee. And it could be remorse. It could be delight. You know, it's going to take a while to register what he's going through. But just know that he's a quark particle in the CERN oscillating. What is that thing called? Hadron Collider. He's in the Android meme quark-tune cubed landscape, bouncing his four bodies off all these other landscapes. And what would be interesting would be to study from the five-body point of view what he's going through, rather than from any particular psychological, sociological, pharmaceutical, therapeutic discipline. You know, they're going to get it wrong from the get-go. And I include humanistic psychology. And what's good about Eric, he knows that.
That's good. That's good. Now, this is interesting, Bob, because, yeah, post-information, that's good. So he totally is not totally, he's off the grid. He's acting under his own something. Something has got him. So what is the something is my question, that something?
The something is, it's a post-information society since the collapse of the Edward Meade, and we watched the past week the divisions, the fragments of the Edward Meade, the left versus the right, pointing fingers at each other, and they're going to be shown to be irrelevant, and it was shown by that. Because, as I've said, it's a post-information society. No information is affecting anybody. The population is probing around, including the bankers, trying to figure out, how can I connect with anything? We're in the mystery landscape. There's no reference points. Now, what's interesting is Eric is saying, yes, that's what humanistic psychology is about, and that's true. But every other discipline is saying the same thing in their terms over the last 20, 30 years. They've all been saying the same syndrome. Hey, we can't use what we know. We got to deal with what is. We got to wing it, and we got to look like we know what we're doing while we're winging it. And that whole Android meme information society process collapsed a couple of years ago. That's why Ion is the greatest commentator for us to play off, because he's working with levels beyond the Android meme, mystery levels, and including the four bodies. It's the only commentary worth checking out. Who gives a damn anyways, in the sense that it's unfortunate for the chemical bodies involved directly with the politician. But there's another thing coming in 2 days that'll knock that off the screen. And it's the violence of the Android meme and its afterimage are presenting new dramatic stories every 3 days. That's a super violent situation. That's the violence of the chip body that no one is, that Katie Couric and Diane Sawyer and Dan Rather and the new guys, they don't, and John Roberts from Toronto, he used to do much music on City TV in the 70s and 80s. He's now a major guy on CBS, I think. He was just a pop culture commentator in the 70s. All these guys do not talk about their role in this terroristic situation.
This is good, Bob. See, now, audience, this is how good Bob is, because I had this question in my head before I asked it to Bob, and I could not imagine that this was his answer, and it's totally just blown my mind. Now, Bob, let's move into your comments on the fan mail we're getting for the podcast. One of the fan mails I got was that your comments on comedians blew this individual's mind. Can you comment on all the positive feedback we're getting, even at this early stage of the game? It's kind of blowing my mind. What do you think?
Well, I know the power of the old Bob Dobb stuff, and I've been doing a lot of different stuff, a different approach with Ion, right? And I've managed to keep the Bob Dobb threads going in dialogues with Kurt Weller and Andrew Crystal and whoever else, Scott Woods, Dave Neufeld. And we even had Dr. Paul Proteus emailed a month or two ago into the Ion show, Cashflow, and said, well, I want some Bob Nevert. Bring some Bob Nevert back, you know, once a month. Now, he's talking about this, we'll call TV body pattern recognition, which I'm an expert at and always am unique with. That is what we're not getting with Ion, really. It's a different approach. And some people who knew what I used to do in Cashflow before Ion were nostalgic for that. Well, it turns out we're doing it here. And if these people, the stuff that, okay, they're blowing their mind on what we're doing. But they went over and listened to the Andrew Crystal dialogues, which I probably listened to some of them, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then the Scott Woods dialogue on rock criticism and the Kurt Weller. I'm always fantastic. Now, it is, what's interesting is everybody I engage, in this case your world, you're bringing in people who don't know of me, you know, your world is who I'm interacting with. And it was sort of, to me, I'm used to people being blown away. So, but I was just enjoying your excitement about it. And it's just beginning, I guess. I just know people don't know this stuff. And I can make it seem like it's worth knowing. So I'm interested. I would like, if someone is blown away, like some of these emails, I would like them to come on not for vanity reasons, and I'd be interested in what they were blown by, because I want to know what my audience is getting. I don't know who they are or what they're thinking. I'm interested in interviewing them, almost like a clinical psychologist. Okay, so you felt this about that insight, or you like this, but what is it, you know? And I would like to know more about it, about what they're particularly reacting to, because I could even tell them more about what blown them away. I'm not interested in creating blown minds.
What are you?
It happened. I'm interested in bringing them back. Now, the back they come back to is a pretty blown place, but I'm not doing it like I was trying to tell Eric. Yeah, it's static, fun, entertainment on service, but I'm serious. And so if I'm having an effect on people, I want to know what they're thinking, and I want to help them through it. I want to clarify, and it may not help them, but I want to say, I got more to say about whatever they're reacting to.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's not like a comedian comes out and I watched George Carlin do it. I haven't seen him in a long time, so I watched something he did, and it was pretty good watching him. But he'll repeat that routine. He'll travel around and do it. And it's interesting what he implies, but it remains on an entertainment level. He's just an eccentric guy critiquing society. He doesn't want to run for president. I'm running for president, or whatever authoritative figure that people require, as a part-time job. It wouldn't be my full thing, because doing this pattern recognition is way more important than just administrating the White House or something, because it's pattern recognition that people are looking for, and I deliver on that.
That's good. Bob, can you hold tight? My cat's whining at the door. Hold on. Hold tight. I apologize. And Bob, I have a question to ask you and Carolyn. Are you in the market for two cats?
No way. But we've never had pets, and we don't want any.
I got two good ones for you.
No, I don't want pets. We're pet enough for each other.
I hear you.
Okay, I'll tell you this. They go over and hear other things I'm doing, like with Andrew Crystal or Kurt Weller. I'll guarantee you they won't like. At some point, they won't like what I talk about. So, you know, people come up, they might meet me, say, hey, you're a nice guy. They like me. I say, you won't like me after a while, because I'm so quadrophenic. I can go into regions that they don't even know someone could do in the same body. So I don't get too excited about compliments, because I know it's going to be a tetradic flip at some point. And then they'll flip out of their disturbance back into liking me again. So it's an ongoing, you know, process of love, hate, blocking, emerging. So what is it that he's blown away by? I don't want him to be blown away. I'm glad he's interested. Well, let's bring him on and have him try to express what he's blown about. And he might not want to come on. He might be trying to be polite and telling you this.
It's a female. But actually, Bob, now, that's quite big of you to not be blown away by compliments, because I'm pretty much affected by compliments. And, you know, the recent fame of the podcast has actually kind of thrown me off. So what's some advice so I don't let all this fame go to my head?
Well, you just hope that it doesn't take your privacy away. It will flip into a disservice. And, you know, at what point, I don't know, but any phenomenon will flip into a disservice. So just remember, it's going to be a disservice in the long run. So don't get too excited about it, or enjoy it, and don't worry that you're enjoying it. Just be ready for when it shifts.
Right. That's my problem. I'm enjoying it, then I'm worried that it's going to shift, and then I'm just freaking out, and I'm like, why am I doing this? Why? I just need to quit this whole thing. Why am I talking to Bob? People are be listening to me talking to Bob. They'll be like, hey, why is he talking to Bob? Oh, that he's weird. He's talking to Bob. And then I'm like, well, you know how it goes.
Okay, hold it. You started to blip out there. Are you still blipping out?
Because I was just freaking out, and the Android meme.
No, you're it's not working. We're going to have to reconnect.
Ah, damn it. Okay.
Well, it's clear now. Were you shifting your position somehow? And
yeah, it's weird. It's very sensitive, these computers.
Yeah, don't move or something, because you can be, it's constant, but just the past minute you were blah, 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 you know, ridiculous. So yeah, so you were saying, yeah, you go, but see, this is the thing, it's a new world for you to broadcast, and have your own discarnate image affecting other people's lives with you kind of like the focal point, that's a new experience for your, I call it your TV body, because you're providing one-way content. It's not interacting email. Like when you call in on a talk show, you just interact and then you say goodbye. Here you got something that sticks. So let's call that the slower realm. That's the TV landscape. And you haven't projected yourself in the TV landscape, I guess, much. And
actually,
you're getting...
Actually, Bob, I have. And that's kind of interesting in itself. I did the Youngblood radio show before this podcast. And I had 100 listeners each time. The highest was 400. And it freaked me out. 400 people listening to me, it freaked me out. Brought up my issues.
So well, let's go into this. Why does it freak you out? Why?
That discarnate thing freaks me out.
It should. It's old hat now, but if you're not aware of it, you should look at what it means for your own body image and what it does to your profession and what it does to humanistic psychology. It alters the images. See, that's what's interesting about what Eric's saying. He's describing the symptoms. I claim to be describing the causes of what his dilemma is or what he wants to do with his profession. And the causes are a bigger factor than any adjustments to what has to be done. So the causes of this discarnate effect on you is a bigger effect of the show rather than the content you're producing.
I like that.
So, you know, you read any books by any famous people, it ain't all fun becoming a figure in the media landscape. There's always a shock and a change and an unforeseen effect that happens to people. So you're getting it on a nano level.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's inferior because it's nano. It's better. It's small scale. You can learn the effects and then move through it and drop it. Or see, I used to on CKLN in the 80s. Used to say, look, everybody should have the experience of coming on and broadcasting and hear and feeling the audience. That's denied people up till recently. Going on the computer, nobody really got on the media in the 50s, 70s, and 80s. And you had to have some situation. But to be able to get on there and feel the discarnate effect and what it does to you alleviates one's fascination with the media. The masses that are all watching TV the last 50 years are really subconsciously desiring to be on there, not to provide interesting content, but to feel the discarnate effect when you are on there and you can feel the audience. If it's a live show, you can feel it. It's a unique psychic experience, like a drug. And that's really what people are dumbed down about. They are staring at TV, fascinated with something, whether they know it or not, that they'd love to be able to experience.
That's good. They're looking for that effect. It is like a drug, and I like this,
yep.
Bob. And if we had some media literacy in the schools, not to get deep with it, but if we had media literacy in the schools and taught this sort of stuff to the kids, you wouldn't have these kids trying to be on reality TV shows and everything, all these things that people talk about and are upset about. They'd have to have media literacy.
It's not media literacy, media experience. That's a good point. The reality shows is not about the reality content. You see, that's why to say the content is trivial, which TV aesthetic critics might say, the culture has been dumbed down. No. What's great about American Idol allows people to experience the getting on there and just feeling the discarnate effect, which is way more important and what they're really desiring unconsciously than whatever side effects they get from the content. Because usually if they win, they go on and they're gone within a couple of months anyways. It is that's a good example of programmers, whatever that guy's name was, Simon, whoever, the main loudmouth on there.
Simon,
you know, he's
now
making millions providing the show. It's nothing at all about the show. It's about people getting on there and feeling its current effect.
Okay, that concludes our third show. I hope you enjoyed it. I thought it raised a number of very interesting points and subjects and questions. So the next show will include the second part of the Eric Dotson interview and more of me and Bob talking about very deep subjects. Right. So please tell your friends and your family about this show. It very well could saved their life. All right. Thank you very much. Goodbye.